Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Stolen by the Mob Boss by Nicole Fox. Narrated by Rita Amos and Indy Chapin. Chapter 1. Lucy. There's a fire on TV. For a moment, I'm unsure what I'm looking at. The TV is across the diner, hoisted up in the corner of the room. But when I squint, I see that the news is reporting on a massive factory fire. I glance out of the window, and as expected, I see the black cloud ominously rising in the air. The fabric factory is quite a few miles away, yet I can still smell it from here. The thought of it sends me back to a place in my memory. Not a happy place. Not a place where I ever wanted to go again. I'm a little girl again, staring out with my nose pressed against the car window, watching as the smoke billows from the shattered windows of my home. All around us, lights flash, red, blue, red, blue, and I squeeze my eyes tight, trying, despite everything, to pretend that I'm not here. I was too young then to understand what happened, at least to truly understand what happened. I heard lots of words when I climbed out of the car and took off running toward the flames. I could hear the policemen shouting at me to stop, and Nana begging me to come back. But above it all, I thought I could hear my parents calling my name. Only they couldn't have been. My parents perished in that fire. A gas leak, that's what the detectives said. Mom and Dad never saw it coming. When Mom flicked on the burner to start dinner, everything went up in flames. Sometimes I wonder what that must have felt like. Did they suffer? Did they feel anything at all? Or was God merciful enough to make it quick and painless? I remember falling to my knees on the front lawn, sobbing as two firemen pulled me away from the flames. My lungs burned and my eyes burned. But more than anything, there was the unshakable hollowness of loss. I'd spent my entire life in that home. Every year on my birthday, Mom would line me up with the doorframe in the kitchen and carve a little mark above my head. Every 4th of July, Dad would invite Nana and all of his family over, and at the end of the night, my cousins and I would sit in my bedroom and throw tiny little poppers at each other. I lost my first tooth in that house. I saw my parents' first fight in that house. And just like that, it was all erased, wiped from existence. There was only one man to blame. The police ruled it an accident, something that could have happened to anyone. But that never sat right with me. Shady real estate dealer Abram Constantine received only a slap on the wrist. A promise you'll be more careful next time? My parents were burned alive, and the only person that was punished was me? Bullshit. Nana says that if I hold on to this for the rest of my life, it'll eat me alive. But the part of me that longs for justice says, let it. Let this ache and sorrow consume me and drive me to find the truth about what happened that day. Let it bring Abram to justice and show the world that the disgustingly wealthy can't be allowed to get away with things like this. I want to make an example of him, to show that every life is precious, and throwing money around doesn't negate the negligence that killed my mom and dad. But the realistic side of me has to let this go. I can't function if I spend all my life holding on to it. There's no future if I'm stuck in the past. So like I always do, I turn away from the television and take a moment to clear my head. This is why I hate slow days. When the regulars are in, I can distract myself. I can plaster on a welcoming smile and be the best waitress Rudy's Diner has ever seen. When it's empty, I find my mind wandering away, crafting daydreams of vengeance. It's exhausting. I turn back to my job, cleaning the counters and rubbing down the cash register. Dirt and grime are no match for the chemical concoction that Madeline and I have created. After growing tired of keeping 7 different cleaning products around, we spent one night creating the perfect solution to clean every last inch of Rudy's. Our manager, Rudy Bradwell, was impressed enough not to yell at us for wasting most of his cleaning supplies while trying to find the right balance. If Nana knew these were the kinds of things I get excited about, she would be proud. All her life, she cleaned up after everyone else. She babysat me while Mom and Dad worked. Dad always told me that she was the strongest woman he knew next to my mother, and I understand why. Even now that I've moved back to town since graduation, Nana still likes to argue with me about taking care of her. I don't know how many times I've heard the phrase, "I'm old, not dead." She's as hard-headed as ever. But every now and then, I feel her gratitude shine through. While I was away at school, Nana didn't have anyone to talk to or keep her company. Most of her old friends have passed away, and while I was gone, very rarely did anyone stop by to say hello. Only a handful of neighbors checked in on her, and I'm thankful that they were able to care for her while I was gone, because I don't know what I would do if anything happened to Nana. After everyone that I've lost, I don't think I could survive another loved one leaving me. "Are you ever not daydreaming?" a familiar voice asks from behind me. I turn to see Madeline approaching with a handful of dirty dishes, a mischievous smile on her face. She's one of the most gorgeous women I've ever seen. Perfectly dyed blonde hair, perfectly white smile, and the kind of curves any woman would kill to have. It makes sense that she's a model when she's not on the clock at Rudy's. "Sorry," I say, blushing. I hate that I have a tendency to get trapped in my head, because I usually end up becoming much more reserved. People often read that as either standoffish or awkward, so I've been trying to live more in the moment and spend less time with my own thoughts. But old habits die hard, or whatever they say.
"You know, I was thinking about what you said last week."
"What did I say last week?" I ask.
Madeline disappears for a moment to drop off the dishes, then steps back out into the diner, hands on her hips.
"You told me no guys were looking in your direction when I asked whether you were dating or not."
I self-consciously brush a lock of hair behind my ear and turn my attention towards the counter, wiping it down.
I hate when Madeline puts on her matchmaker boots and tries to set me up with different guys. I mean, of course I appreciate her offer and the fact that she tries to introduce me to new people, but her taste in guys doesn't match mine. She likes older, obscenely wealthy guys that have connections. Not exactly my type.
"But," Madeline continues, "I think the truth is that you're sabotaging yourself. That guy with the red hair during breakfast today is proof of that."
"What are you talking about?"
I ask, trying hard not to blush.
"You know exactly what," she says, laughing.
"I saw the way he was looking at you and how he kept trying to get you to sit down and talk to him. He was hot. We both know that."
"He was attractive, yes."
"Why didn't you go for it then? Why didn't you sit down and talk to him?"
I sigh and turn around, leaning against the counter with one hip. "Because I'm on the clock, and he had a tan line where his wedding ring used to be. He probably just got out of a marriage, and I don't want to deal with all that baggage."
Madeline clicks her teeth and shakes her head at me. "This is what I'm talking about. You keep finding reasons not to go for men. You're sabotaging yourself so you never get close to them."
"My God, it's like Dr. Phil is in the diner with me," I groan.
I toss the rag behind me into a bucket full of other dirty napkins and wipes.
Maybe I just don't feel like dating right now. Maybe with everything going on with Nana and my writing and this job, dating just isn't high on my priority list.
Madeline shrugs.
"Maybe, but I know you. I've seen you fawn over guys one minute and then find something wrong with them and turn your back the next. All I'm saying is it couldn't hurt to give a guy a chance before you turn him away. I think you could meet someone really special."
Despite all of her nagging, I know Madeline wants to be helpful and this is her way of showing it. Other people might grow annoyed with her incessant nudging and prodding whenever an attractive man walks into Rudy's, but it comes from a good place, so I don't let it bother me too much. Anyway, she says, glancing around at the nearly empty diner, we should probably get started on cleaning up after the breakfast crew. Lunch will be here soon. Sounds like a plan, I say. When I close the front door behind me, the first thing I hear is a gasp from the living room. Something's wrong with Nana. My heart rate spikes. I drop my purse, clattering to the ground, and spring around the corner as dark thoughts race through my head. Maybe she fell, or had a stroke, or someone broke in, and... Nope. I race in the room to find Nana with her eyes glued to the television. One of her soap operas is playing, and it looks like someone just got shot by a masked gunman. I let out a heavy sigh. My body begins to unwind, and I scold myself for being so paranoid. I can't live every day anticipating the worst, but it's another one of my tough habits to break. After everything that I've lost, seeing Nana join that list might just be too much for me. Hi, sweetheart, Nana says, without looking away from the television. Hi, Nana. I pull off my jacket and hang it up in the hallway, taking a seat on the big purple sofa next to her. It may be hideous, but the couch is one of the softest things I've ever sat on in my life. And though it doesn't go with anything in the room, I think that's how Nana likes it. Nothing in her home makes sense. She has massive paintings on the wall that span various artistic styles, from modern images of puppies to pop art replicas of celebrities and surrealist landmarks across the globe. Her rugs range from faux fur to handmade crocheted ones, and all the furniture in the house was picked up from yard sales or gifted to her after friends passed away. To say that Nana's house is a collaborative group effort would be an understatement. That's what I love about it. None of it makes any sense, but when it's all together, that kind of chaos is harmonious. We sit in silence for a moment while the show's climax plays out on the screen before us. When it goes to commercial break, she turns to me, pats my hand, and smiles. How was work? She asks. It was okay. Relatively slow, but we got a lot of regulars in. Did you see that fire on the news? Her voice is soft. I swallow hard and look up at her. I've never expressed the bit of PTSD I feel whenever I see things like that on the news. But Nana knows. Sometimes I wonder if she's been a mind reader this whole time. Rather than saying anything, I just give her a slow nod.
Are you okay?
The way she says it almost brings tears to my eyes. Nana has this distinct ability to be stern and strong and confident when she needs, but also uncomfortably tender and caring. It always throws me for a loop when she switches it up and cuts right to the point. Yeah, I say quietly. I pick at the tattered edge of one of her throw pillows, keeping my focus on anything but the soft brown eyes staring at me. I don't think it'll ever be easy.
It won't, she confirms. But you'll learn how to cope better. You'll learn how to take it all in, feel it, but not let it overtake you and your thoughts.
That all sounds nice and dandy, but I don't know if I'll ever be strong enough to somehow do what she does. I can't imagine never feeling a twisting knife in my gut anytime I think about what happened to Mom and Dad. Not only is the wound still open from the fact that I lost them, but it's made even worse, salt sprinkled on top, because Abram Constantine will never be punished for what he did. Years ago, I sat down and tried to figure out everything I could about him. I wanted to know the man responsible for the death of my parents. I wanted to know who he was and why he was able to skate through life without any kind of repercussions for his actions. More frustrating than anything else was that he was essentially a ghost. The only articles I could find about him in English were about his real estate dealings and all the businesses he ran in the city.
His entire online identity was a sterilized wasteland of uninteresting articles and pictures posing with powerful people. Though my findings were limited, I took note of all the people he was close with. Millionaires and billionaires, powerful people in town. He associated with the top of the top, and suddenly it started making sense. He didn't get away with negligence because the police truly found him innocent. He used a more precious capital, one that wasn't palpable, but still carried more weight than cash. He had connections. He had people that could help him sweep the ash of my singed childhood under the rug, away from the public eye. There's no way in hell I'll let this go. But for Nana's sake, I give her a small smile and a nod. "I'll try," I say. My answer seems to satisfy her, because I watch as she leans back in her seat more comfortably. "Are you okay?" I rise from the couch and take a step toward her, grabbing one of her pillows and fluffing it up. Recently, Nana had a health scare, and I've basically become like her mother, always doting on her and trying to make her as comfortable as I can.
"I'm fine, darling," she says.
She pats my hand again reassuringly, and just like I lied to her about trying to let the fire go, I can see that she's filtering her words and holding back what she really wants to say. I can't blame her. Strokes aren't anything to speak lightly of, no matter how minor. "I just want you to be okay. Even if it means taking more shifts at Rudy's so that I can afford your medicine. Whatever it takes, Nana," I say. There's nothing that I wouldn't do for her, and I want her to know that without a shadow of a doubt.
"Lucy," she says almost sternly.
I stop flitting around and look down into those deep blue eyes.
"I'm the grown-up here. I'm taking care of you, baby. You shouldn't be worried about me. What you should be worried about is having fun and meeting a nice man."
It takes all my strength to hold back a groan. 2 times in 1 day is a little too much for me. "Nana, I don't need a man."
"Nobody needs a man, Lucy, but they're fun to have around. And I want you to experience that. I want you to settle down with someone nice. At least try."
"Okay." There's no point in arguing with her about this. And I'm afraid that if I do, she'll get worked up and be sick again. "I'll make you a deal. As long as you take the next few days off, I'll go looking for a husband and we'll make some grandbabies for you. How does that sound?" Her chuckle is sugar sweet, and I find myself growing warm from just her presence. Anytime I start to feel anxious, I turn to her for relief.
"That's my girl."
The commercials end, and just like that, her attention is now laser-focused on the twisty, complex storyline playing out on the screen. I've lost her to her stories, but that's okay. I have stories of my own to write. I give Nana a heads up that I've put lunch in the oven for her, then grab my laptop bag and head downstairs. There's a tiny little coffee shop a few blocks away, and with my headphones blaring my favorite song, it takes almost no time to make the trip. I step through the doors and give a small nod to the barista I see every afternoon. While I get my laptop set up and go searching for the location that I saved my manuscript, I can't help but feel like such a stereotype. Nana getting sick was the biggest reason I decided to come back to New York. But another reason is the fact that here, my opportunities of having my work discovered are so much higher. New York is full of possibilities for unpublished authors, and I know that deep in my heart, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Storytelling was always my passion growing up. And when I got to college, I took my first creative writing class. There, I had the idea that I'm currently working on. It's about a woman losing her child to a notorious murderer in town. And after years of looking, she finds the first clue that could lead her to find out what truly happened that night at the deadly lake behind her home.
It's marketable, that much I know.
But the hard part for me is finding the time to finish it.
Between working at Rudy's and taking care of Nana, I rarely have time to sit down and just be with my characters.
At work, my mind wanders back to thoughts of scenes in my book. And with Nana, I think about what my protagonist would be doing if someone was depending on her the way Nana depends on me. Sitting there with my computer open and my notes spread out on the table, though, I find inspiration and let it take me in whatever direction it needs me to go in. As much as I love organization, I don't plan my books. I see the story in my head and the way I get there, but the fun part is figuring out the smaller scenes and all the ways to make those interesting so that no scene feels like it could be removed from the rest of the story. Before I know it, I've typed almost 3,000 words, major progress from where I started. My heroine, Mallory, has just been run off the road by the killer's equally unstable cousin, and her head is bleeding. As much as I want to sit and finish the scene, I decide to leave it on a cliffhanger. There will be plenty of time for me to revisit this world later on. On the way out, I order a couple cookies and begin my trek home, my thoughts floating like zero gravity. How do I get my protagonist out of this situation? Is she too far gone now? And if she is, how can I give her the strength to fight her way out? I'd like to be like her, determined, persistent, and all-around badass. But nothing like that ever happens in my life. Nothing this exciting or dangerous or reckless. Maybe that's why I'm writing. Nana and Madeline would say that I could have all that with a man. I shake my head and smile to myself. Maybe they're right. Maybe I just need to find the right man.
Chapter 2. Roman. Each of us is born with a gift, a special talent. Some people act, some people dance, some people sing a fucking jingle. Me, on the other hand, I kill. And tonight is another chance to show the world my gift. Waiting is the worst part of this job. Memories are the only thing that help pass the time. Leaning against the exterior wall of this nightclub, the memory of my first kill comes back to me. Like most of my memories, it ends with blood. It was late August when the weather was finally starting to get colder, and the city folk began trading t-shirts for flannels and jackets. My father took my brothers and me hunting for the first time. We'd spent a good few months learning how to shoot both guns and arrows, and he wanted to see how well we'd do after our lessons. The crunch of leaves under my boots was so vivid that I can feel the texture of them to this day. The wind whipped our faces as we hiked from our truck through the hills until finally we stumbled into a bit of clearing. At first, there wasn't much to see. A squirrel clung to a large oak tree, a collection of rocks growing moss on the sides. My father asked us if we saw anything. We said no. "Then look harder." That's when I saw the tiny brown rabbit pressed against the trunk of a tree, quietly nibbling food. My father gave me a look. As the oldest, I knew what it meant. I'd seen it plenty of times before. Narrowed eyes, lips pulled into a thin, straight line. I had to set the example. Quietly, I pulled an arrow from my quiver and knocked it, pulling back the bowstring. I steadied myself and set my jaw, holding the position until I could feel the right moment to strike. The air in my chest stopped, and I felt the world begin to disappear, every external distraction ceasing to exist. Then I let go. The arrow sliced through the air in silence. Before my brothers Gideon and Ivan could blink, the rabbit was dead, pinned to the tree. I let out a breath and glanced at my father. The only indication that I'd done a good job was the short nod of his head, the most subtle of compliments. It was enough to satisfy me, for a moment. One rabbit alone wasn't enough, however. I wanted more. I wanted bigger, more dangerous. We worked our way up from there. My brothers didn't have a knack for killing, nor did they like it the way I did. Raccoons, deer, elk, even a bear once, with a perfect shot through its eye. My father seemed pleased with my skill. For years we honed it, improving how quietly I moved, how long I waited before pulling the trigger, savoring the exhilarating feeling of a perfect strike. Like all good things in my life, however, it didn't last. My father didn't last either. It took the murder of my family to push me onto the pursuit of the most dangerous game of all, men. My father had two brothers, Alexander and Andre. Even as a child, I felt the tension. They never stopped by the house unless there was trouble and they needed their big brother to come and fix their messes. Everything with them seemed to be business exchanges, no warmth or familiarity. They always bothered me. I was right to be suspicious of them. The night they proved that, I was in the hospital with stomach pains. Food poisoning of some kind, nothing too serious. When the nurse stepped in with an officer, I thought I'd done something wrong. But they weren't there to chastise me. They were there to tell me that my parents and younger brothers had been murdered. They didn't say by whom or why, or answer any of the other million questions I had. They just told me that I couldn't go home. Police were there investigating. My uncles were on their way to pick me up. None of it made sense. I was a kid, and in my mind, this was all some weird medically induced dream, or rather, a nightmare. But that solemn look on the nurse's face is seared into my memory like a cattle brand. She looked down at me with pity, and I knew she was telling the truth. For a long time, I never knew exactly what happened. My uncles comforted me and helped me when they could. But at 17 years old, I was nearly an adult. I could live on my own. For a while, I managed. I rebuilt. I took my shit-covered situation and made it work. That's how I always was. I got by. But then I found the truth. It wasn't a random act of violence that stole my family from me. It wasn't some fucked-up junkie looking for a score, or a home invader with the wrong address. The innocent blood was on my uncle's hands. The same uncles who'd picked me up from the hospital on the worst night of my life, who'd been taking care of me in the months and years since. They were the ones responsible. They were the motherfuckers who ruined everything for me. So I made a decision then and there. I would make them regret not killing me too. A scream across the street from the nightclub yanks me out of my memories. I see a skimpily dressed brunette giggling and running away from a man. He has his phone out recording her, cheering her on and encouraging her to say something for her social media account. For a moment, they're the most entertaining thing around outside of this scummy club.
"Knock it off," she chirps.
"Make me," he growls playfully.
They end up making out against the brick wall. It's sad. It's pathetic. And yet, in some ways, I'm almost jealous. They're so naive, it's incredible. In the timeless wonderland of their social media newsfeed, every moment is captured forever like a bug trapped in amber. They'll never grow old. They'll never die. They'll be young until the end of time, untouchable. They haven't seen the shit I've seen. They know nothing of the underworld vibrating beneath their feet and before their eyes. Oblivious and carefree, this night will be one they remember fondly, or forget entirely. But there's one man who will never forget tonight. Mr. Joshua Hollis, the man I've been sent to collect. The back door to the club opens and a drunk man comes stumbling out, patting himself down until he locates his pack of cigarettes. He takes one out and lights it. I watch as the cloud of smoke begins to fade into the night. Bingo. I don't know what my client wants with this man, and that's none of my fucking business either.
I learned a long time ago that not knowing is better. These are targets, they're not people. Get too attached to them, and it just makes delivering the body that much more difficult. Out of the corner of my eye, I see the couple still making out, giggling and moaning softly.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?